Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative, and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about the issues across our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by government accountability reporter Josh Keefe, election and government reporter Matt Juncker, and senior reporter Rose Lundy, who covers healthcare. Before we get to today's stories, I'd like to mention this. This month is our two-year anniversary of the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. It's been a great collaboration with WERU over the last 2 years, and we want to hear from you, our listeners, to get your thoughts. Do you listen to this show regularly? Are you listening live to the archive version? Are you listening as a podcast? If you're enjoying the show, what do you like about it? Is there anything you think we can be doing better? You can reach us by email at editors@themainemonitor.org. Again, that email address is editors@themainemonitor.org. Please let us know if we can read your comments on air, and we look forward to hearing from you. All right, on to today's show. So we are recording this on Thursday, April 30th, and we actually just had some huge news this morning that Governor Janet Mills has dropped out of the U.S. Senate race. So I think we are all kind of still digesting this a little bit, but this means that barring any huge surprises, Graham Plattner will run for U.S. Senate against Susan Collins. So Matt and Josh, I just want to start here by getting your reactions to this news. Matt, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, sure. I think this is one of those things that is both shocking and not surprising at the same time. You know, we have a sitting governor of our state who's won two statewide elections, pretty convincingly. The idea that someone in that position would then be bowing out of a primary early, you know, is kind of on its face shocking. But, you know, in recent weeks, it's really felt like we're sort of trending toward maybe not this exact decision, but, you know, the polling was pretty consistently lopsided, and we all, you know, put different stock in polls. But when you're getting poll after poll, you know, with a consistently wide margin, that certainly, you know, shows you something about where the race is at, you know, and fundraising as well. And you've had bits and pieces throughout, you know, whether it was TV ad buys and other things where it kind of felt like this is where this was trending. You had earlier this week, basically, Graham Plattner's campaign sort of seeming like they were already declaring victory in this primary. So it's not a surprising development, but just the idea that someone who has been in politics as long as Governor Mills has and seen such statewide electoral success, you know, in two governor's races, to then not even make it all the way through the primary is just, I think, an interesting moment for Maine politics right now. But I'd be interested to hear what Josh has to say as well.
No, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, it's not just that she didn't make it, it's that she dropped out against a guy with no kind of a random guy from Sullivan with no political experience and a bunch of baggage, but whose campaign seems to have really caught fire. And, you know, there will be all sorts of national, you know, pundits trying to say what this says about the Democratic Party nationally and you know, about sort of left-wing insurgency. And it's all interesting, but, you know, I think it really is. It's unclear how much the specifics of this race can really be kind of universalized across the country. But yeah, I mean, it seems like it's been heading this way for a while. And I think, you know, the big thing was she, you know, that she ran these attack ads against Plattner, and they didn't seem to really work. And so I think, you know, on some level they probably had to decide, are we going to go scorched earth and really, you know, kind of bloody this thing up and make it really, really rough and maybe help Collins in the process, or is it time to step aside?
Yeah, shocking but not surprising is maybe a good that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And yeah, Josh, I want to stay on you because we really want to talk to you about this story that you worked on for several months. We published it in April about really what's behind Plattner's success. And you know, I don't want to bury the lead here. So for people who haven't read the story, you went to high school with Graham Plattner at John Bapps Memorial High School in Bangor. That's where the piece starts. You have this amazing superlatives yearbook photo actually in the piece, which I love so much. And you are the most likely to shop in Lost and Found, which I thought was just an excellent superlative. So take it, like, let's start there. Like, take us back to Plattner in high school. What was he like?
Yeah, I mean, he was in a lot of ways, I think he was kind of the same guy he is now. You know, he ran for class president in this kind as or school president, I should say, on this sort of like jokingly maybe not revolutionary platform. I put in the piece like I don't remember much about sort of the debates for the election, but I do remember there was a moment where he was like, we like they can't suspend us all, like we can kind of rise against some policy. I'm sure it was, you know, ridiculous, but he had that kind of like fervor, I guess. He you know he got he skipped school to interrupt and protest a George W. Bush appearance at the Bangor International Airport, where he got thrown out of by Secret Service. You know, when we voted him most likely to start a revolution. And so yeah, I mean he was a very you know he was a kid who was sure of himself and had big beliefs, you know, even then.
Yeah, so you sat down with him a couple of times for this piece, right? And talk about, you know, how do his views now compare to his views in high school?
Yeah, I mean, I think like all of us, his views have become quite a bit more refined since high school. But you know, I think he's similarly kind of interrogating power structures and like he was then, and similarly, you know, thinking sort of big. You know, why can't you know? Now it's sort of why can't we have universal healthcare, like why can't we have Medicare for all? So yeah, I mean, in the sense that it's sort of, you know, he wants to start a revolution, or people thought he did anyway. Yeah, I mean, I think he's very much the same guy. Obviously, he's been through it, you know, as we all have, a lot of formative experiences since then. But yeah, it wasn't you know, he remembered me, but you know, it'd be clear, like we haven't been friends since then. Like I graduated high school, went off college, he joined the Marines, like we haven't talked or seen each other since. But yeah, he is, you know, he's in a lot of ways the same guy. It's like, you know, when you kind of see somebody from your high school running for office, I think a lot of people I went to high school with, I'd be like, oh, that person, like they were so unserious then, or like they were, I just knew them when we were a kid. And with Plattner, I think it's like, oh yeah, no, that totally tracks.
Yeah, so let's come back to the present day. Obviously this race has gotten a ton of coverage, not just in Maine, but nationally. So knowing that, you know, when there'd been so much written about Plattner already, where did you decide to start reporting on this?
Well, the thing, I think the big thing was, that we talked about was there was a lot of writing about Plattner. But there was a couple of things with that. One is there wasn't a lot of writing about Plattner and Mills, which is sort of where we want to start, is if, you know, start looking at both of them. And then secondly, it was just, there's a lot of writing like nationally where people drop in for a day or two and interview Plattner or go to an event, and then they leave and they, you know, they go back to New York or Washington and say, here's what this means for the Democratic Party nationally. And like, I think we were just thinking, like, let's actually report this on the ground for a long time. Let's go to lots of events. Let's talk to lots of voters. and understand it through the lens of how voters are hearing it, not how like the political chattering class is viewing it. So what that meant was just going to a lot of events for both Mills and Plattner. I think we didn't really know what the story was going to be for a while. We were just trying to talk to as many people as possible, go to as many events as possible, get sit down interviews with both of them. But after a while, it seemed pretty clear that the story was, how is Graham Plattner doing this? Because by the time we were writing it, I mean, poll after poll showed him double digit. I mean, some cases 25, 27, 30 points ahead. So it was sort of, how is this guy from nowhere? I mean, who has no political background with, this incredibly controversial tattoo and these Reddit comments. How is he beating a two-term sitting governor? And not just beating her, but like seemingly running away with it. So that's really what the story was trying to answer.
Yeah, we're going to get to the controversies piece too, but first, like as I think you talked to more than 50 people, right, for this piece.
Yeah, about
Yeah.
that, yeah.
And you went to all these campaign events, as you said. What did stick out to you as you started talking to people and going to events? Like, what was different about his approach and message?
Well, I think a couple of things really stuck out to me. One is that, and I guess this is, I mean, this is more about Mills, but one is that there were so many people I talked to who were like, I really like Governor Mills. I appreciate what she's done as governor. I've voted for her, but I think we need somebody new. So it wasn't like, I was just, I, and this, what I was really struck by was how many older voters said that. Older voters who were just like, I think we got to hand over to a younger generation. And we're either thinking about Plattner or we're gonna vote for Plattner. And I think we all kind of thought that, oh, he's kind of this young, rising star, kind of more, left wing. He's gonna get the younger voters. And I think a lot of people thought, well, that's all well and great. It's Maine. It's a very old state. Old people come out and vote. Mills has that block. He can't win. And what kind of became clear was like, oh no, that block was actually, he was making big inroads there. But to answer your question, I just think his whole thing is not, we need to reach out. We're Democrats. We need to reach out to the working class. We need to pitch better to the working class, in this idea that we need to woo the working class. Like, he's like, no, we need to, the working class needs to take over the Democratic Party. Like, it's not a matter of bringing the working class in. It's a matter of the working class taking over and getting rid of these politicians that, may throw us a bone here or there, but aren't really serving our interests. And I think that message, really resonated with people who are frustrated, with Democrats who are frustrated with their party.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have a good line in the piece that the Mills campaign was really running this like sort of rules-based, lawyerly approach to politics, and Plattner was very focused on building this whole movement. And
Yeah, he talks about power all the time. His whole thing is, we need to build power and then use that power to help people's material, help the material conditions improve in people's lives. And I think that has resonated with large amounts of Democrats who feel like Democrats are sort of, they're just always a kind of lost in these policy details and like what we can do or what we can't do, what president says and all this. And he's kind of like, you guys, we're in a gunfight. Like, you gotta, you brought a knife. Like, we gotta upgrade,
Yeah, I think that you have a good line in there from when he and his wife decided to run, that they said, only if this is an organizing strategy first and electoral strategy second, which I thought was really telling. So you mentioned the controversies. I think most people are going to be familiar with them at this point. I don't know that we really need to go too deep into them here. I will say that your story did reignite one of them, which is, around his use of the R word, in a quote to you when he was describing his response to the rumor that he had a white supremacist tattoo. That use in the piece sparked several, pieces actually in reaction, including one in Mother Jones, where, disabilities rights advocates were really voiced real concern over that. But I would say that, like, broadly speaking, these controversies have not hurt him with most voters. I think that was what, your reporting showed and talking to people around the state. And you talked about a piece in the piece about a Zoom call with Mills over in the spring where, people were sort of more outraged by her attempts to draw attention to these transgressions than they were about the transgressions themselves. So, like, what is that about? Why has this not stuck to him?
I think there's a couple things. One is that he said, I mean, there's basically two things with him, right? It's he was on Reddit. He said, he said made comments about sexual assault in 2013. He's made other more controversial statements recently, well, more recently, I should say. But that's sort of the big one. And then the tattoo, which is seems to be Totenkopf, which is a Nazi symbol. He said he thought it was a skull and crossbones. Him and his Marines buddy, him Marine buddies got it when they were in Croatia, I believe. Like in when they were deployed. Or between deployments. So yeah, and he said he didn't know what it was. But I think it really gets to like I think it's very the all these I think all these controversies are like very different if he's like a successful business owner or a lawyer who's running after being in politics for a while. I think these things to a lot of people feel like the kind of messy real lives that like real people live. Not to excuse any of them, but like, I just talked to a lot of people who were like, yeah, I've said dumb stuff on the internet. I'm glad I'm not running for office. Or like, yeah, I've got stupid tattoos. I don't care. Like he's, or just like, I don't care. Like he's saying, I'm listening to what he's saying. There was a lot of that. And so I think it's sort of like, it just adds to his, a lot of it, I think, adds to his kind of image as like a real Mainer down here in the real world, who's flawed and has struggled and isn't trying, hasn't been trying to put together a resume to run for office for his whole life. I mean, that's what I've heard from a lot of people and talking to voters. But honestly, yeah, I mean, it didn't seem. I just don't think it. If you were willing to listen to his message, I don't think it really turned you off. If you were already against kind of this more populist approach, then it's extra reason to not like him, you know?
Yeah. And I think, in the piece, you point out, through your reporting that what you found was like Trump really changed the rules on this and they're just not going to go back, I think was what, you pointed out that, which is sort of the opposite of the message that Mills was bringing, that this return to the sort of pre-Trumpian politics was still possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other thing is like a lot of Democrats are like, I mean, look at the things Trump has said and done. And it's like we're gonna hold ourselves to this standard that the other side is not gonna hold themselves to. But yeah, I mean, to speak to that, like, the big thing about the Mills campaign is like, I will stand up to Trump. I will stand up to Trump. And Plattner's basically saying, like, we need to create a world in which a Donald Trump is impossible because we take care of people's material lives to the extent that they aren't angry looking for scapegoats, which is his argument, is that's what Trump's provided, right? Like, people are suffering, and Trump and Trumpism offers a target for that, for the anger that comes out of that, right? Whether it's immigrants or trans people, like here are the who you should blame for your suffering. He's saying we just got to stop the suffering, and then Donald Trump is impossible. I mean, it's his, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but Whereas Mills seems like it's all this, I'm gonna stand up to him, I'm gonna stand up to him, but it's sort of like unclear what that means. And I think Democrats have been running for a while on this idea of standing up to Trump, and he's kind of saying like, no, we need to build the post-Trump world. And I think a lot of Democrats are ready for that.
Yeah, I think that resonated with people from what, from everybody that you talked to. Well, something that was interesting to me recently was I've actually had a few conversations, actually before the piece came out and one after, where people said to me, they'd read a lot about the controversies about him, but they couldn't actually explain what his platform was to their friends. Could you articulate that to the extent that you understand it?
Yeah, I mean, his big thing is Medicare for all. The government should be providing health care, and the problem with health care is that there's too much for-profit motive in it, essentially. He wants to tax wealth at a similar rate as labor, right? So the money you get out of your paycheck, that tax rate is higher than the tax rate on capital gains, right? When you certain taking money out of your investment or whatever. So his whole argument is like, if you tax labor at a higher rate than wealth, like just run that, keep running those numbers, and you're gonna see the wealth gap explode. So he's like, let's hold that back in alignment, or I'm not sure exactly. I don't think he's put up
Yeah,
pros
he
and
wants to change.
percentages or whatever, but wealth should be taxed at a higher rate than labor. He wants to reduce wants to eliminate the cap on Social Security taxes, which kind of goes along with that, right? So your wages are taxed for Social Security only up to a certain point. I think it's 180,000 now. And beyond that, your wages are not taxed. It's not, Social Security isn't taken out of that. So his whole argument is like, well, we're so worried about not having enough money for Social Security, why don't we just tax everybody the same on it, no matter how much money you make, instead of limiting it to this amount. And then wants stronger protections for unions. I've been to a lot of his events, so I've heard this spiel a few times. But yeah, I'll stop there. It's all this very populist tilting the sort of system back toward, he would say, working people, and away from powerful interests, essentially.
Great. Well, thank you, Joss. Thanks for going over that story. It's fascinating. For those who haven't had a chance to read it, it's on the Monitor's website. We need to take a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, I'm joined by Government Accountability Reporter Josh Keefe, Elections and Government Reporter Matt Yunker, and Senior Reporter Rose Lundy, who covers healthcare. So, Matt, I want to turn to you now. You started earlier this month, well, I guess in mid-April, I should say, as our Elections and Government Reporter. Listeners might be familiar with your byline. You came to us from the Bangor Daily News, where you were most recently covering sports, including doing lots of great coverage of Cooper Flagg. We're obviously really thrilled to have you at the Monitor, especially during such an important election season, where, as we've just been talking about, means garnering a lot of national attention. And you're going to be doing a lot of important work covering the races, of course, as well as putting together resources for our election hub, including comprehensive voter guides. Just for listeners, we'll be launching our election hub early this month. So, head over to themainmonitor.org and check it out. It's under Guides to Government. Matt, in such a big year, talk us through how you are thinking about approaching election coverage.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think I start kind of with that notion of it being such a big year. And I think we hear every election cycle, right? That this is the most important election of the decade or of our lifetimes. It's a common refrain. But I do think we are experiencing a particularly interesting election cycle here in Maine, kind of across the board. Obviously, as we you and Josh have just been talking about, there's a lot of interest in and national implications for the Senate race. And much like we saw in 2020, there is going to be a lot of national attention, a lot of national money pouring into the state, already has been, but in the next few months. So I think that, that's going to be critically important in terms of unpacking the policies and the politics of it, but also the finances behind it, helping people understand, the perspectives and the money behind a lot of the ads and arguments that we're going to be seeing over the next few months. But I think more immediately, we just have, it feels like half the state is running for governor or for Congress right now. And so just helping people understand that primary ballot, especially in Maine, where we use ranked choice voting in the primaries, where you have I think that the total number of people running for governor, it's over 10. And then when you throw the independents in the mix as well, I mean, it's a good chunk of people. And so a lot of policies, perspectives, and personalities to help voters understand. So that's sort of where I start. But I think in this role and in this election season, there's going to be a necessity to pare back sort of the process behind some of these elections as well. This also happens to be an election, as is common here in Maine, but we're going to have at least one referendum question on the ballot, as it relates to trans students' inclusion both in sports and other school facilities. And we're already going to see there's a the Secretary of State has scheduled a hearing on that initiative. There's already been a challenge to it being on the ballot for the middle of this month. And so you're going to see that process play out in sort of the mechanics of it. And I think there are going to be many steps along the way where it's going to be important to help readers understand what and why those various process parts are happening as well. It's not just going to be, there's going to be a lot of politics and personalities and the money behind it, but also just the sort of mechanics of democracy, and sort of things that make Maine unique in that way, like the ranked choice voting system. This is also going to be the first, I think, real election that we see the open primaries process involved as well. And I don't mean real, not to diminish other, the previous time that it's used, but like it had just been stood up before. I think this is maybe the first time that we're going to see it, people be more aware of it, and I think more of an uptick in it. Also, in sort of a have it happening in such a closely contested and watched race. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how that new development just on the election administration front plays out in the state as well.
Yeah, we're gonna talk a little bit about ranked choice voting in a minute. But it's been fascinating to see like all these notices come through my email of groups endorsing three candidates, which is really kind of funny as a voter to see that. And then, yeah, and we've got a lot of familiar names in these races too, which I think is just been a really fascinating development. And so, yeah, let's talk about some of the work you've been doing so far. You've actually been at the Maine GOP and Maine Democratic conventions over the last few weeks, and you've been talking to Democratic and Republican primary candidates for governor and Congress. We're going to have those videos up. You did video interviews with, I think, everybody, right? Or everybody who was there. We're getting videos of everyone.
Still in the works, but yeah, we're building
Okay.
that up.
Well, we'll have videos up on our website of everyone, so you can go and check out all of the candidates. But just so far from your takeaways, like what stood out to you about those conversations? Were there themes that emerged?
I mean, if there's one overarching theme, and it kind of lends back to what I was just saying, but I think, there are so many people running that, sometimes you have candidates who are a little cagey about talking to the press or about sharing too much at different points in a campaign. And I think especially what I've seen, saw at the GOP convention in particular, is everybody wants to talk to you because they're trying to distinguish themselves from, seven other people in a race sometimes. And so there's what I see happening right now is a very, and I think it's a direct correlation to the volume of people in some of these races, particularly for governor, is there's a pretty robust conversation happening right now because there are so many people in the mix. And I think you're going to see that as debate season continues as well, is that, there's so many people on that stage. There's only so many ways to distinguish yourself. So you have these candidates who are sort of taking any avenue possible to stand out from the five, six, seven other people they're running against. I do think it's going to be interesting to see in the coming weeks how Governor Mills stepping back from the Senate race impacts, I think, the dialogue across the board, because I think both at the state house level, and people running to replace her, there's been either sort of on some sides the Democrats looking maybe to take up her mantle, in some ways I think they've also been trying to distinguish themselves. But you've had a lot of Republicans talking about all the things that they see as going wrong in Augusta over the past 8 years of unified Democratic control. And some of that, I think, has there's been some interplay into, used as to criticize her in the Senate race. So I think you'll see less of that sort of crosstalk across races, but you still, I think, are going to be there's going to be a lot of debate over what we've seen in Augusta these past 8 years. And it's, Republicans, for the most part, have been highly critical of what they see happening. Democrats, you're going to see, I think, in some ways, you have some of the gubernatorial candidates, for example, who have worked in the Mills administration, either, defending things that they specifically did, whether it's housing policy or, the reaction and efforts to deal with the COVID pandemic as it was happening. So you have either folks either defending that or distancing themselves from it. So there's going to be a lot of that interplay as well, I think, over and you might have very different you do already hear very different perspectives of where Maine stands, how we've been doing the past 8 years, and where we need to go from here. So I think that will be very interesting. And that question at the state house level as well, there's obviously going to be a lot of national attention on the Senate race, and in some cases the governor's race as well. But I think we could have a very interesting scenario here at the state house where, I mean, we've had unified Democratic control for 8 years, that the House in particular is kind of a razor thin margin for Democrats now. So it'll be interesting to see those campaigns, how they play out in the coming months, and what it means if we return to what had previously been a very common scenario in Maine, where we have, perhaps a Republican controlled House or Senate and vice versa in the other body. For the last 8 years, we've seen the same party control all three major levers of government in Augusta in terms of the two houses of the legislature and the Blaine House. And so I think it'd be interesting to see if that remains the case come next January. I think given the margins and the conversations, I think the odds seem good that we may not be in exactly the same place then that we are now.
I'm not going to ask you to make predictions, but I am curious. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about a story that you got out this week about ranked choice voting. I think a lot of people are kind of familiar with ranked choice voting, but they don't really pay attention to it until they actually get into the voting booth and they see their options. So let's set the stage a little bit here and remind people a little of the history. How long has ranked choice voting been around in Maine, and what races is it used in?
So at the statewide level, Maine voters supported a statewide referendum question all the way back in 2016 that was supposed to enact ranked choice voting for the governor's race, general election as well, for all federal offices and for state legislative races. Now that was passed in 2016, 52% of Maine voters approved it. However, it's never been fully implemented. We have been using sort of a hybrid approach to ranked choice voting since 2018, but it is only used in the general elections for federal offices. That's, US Senate and Congress. And it is, or congressional seats, I should say. And it is only used in the primary races for governor and for state house. And it's very complicated, but the simplest explanation I can give you for that is the Maine Constitution. The state Supreme Judicial Court has now twice provided non-binding advisory opinions, basically weighing in to say that because of a plurality provision in the Maine Constitution for those races, and because ranked choice voting requires majority winners, that it is effectively not constitutional. Doesn't comport with the state constitution. This is a matter of state constitutionality, not federal constitutionality. And now the court rulings are more complicated than that. And the second one is not, they didn't say exactly the same as the first one did back in 2017. But that's sort of essentially the issue here, is that since for about 150 years, since the late 1800s, Maine's constitution has required plurality voting, and the court has essentially ruled that that plurality provision, plus some of the definitions and vote counting processes laid out in the Constitution, is in conflict for certain races. The ones that are specifically laid out in the Maine Constitution, is in conflict with ranked choice voting. So it's very complicated, but the practical result of all of that is that ranked choice voting is used in some of Maine's statewide elections, but not all. And that's where we are right now, but that we could talk for a long time as well about where we might go from here.
Well, I am glad that was a pretty good simple explanation. I think that helped me for sure. They actually, the Maine Supreme Court just weighed in on this issue pretty recently. So what did the justices say?
So the justices weighed in, and this gets into another wonky process within the state constitution, but the legislature, the Maine legislature, this most recent session passed a bill that attempted to expand ranked choice voting to those other offices and to the general elections that it's not currently used in. And what that effort was based on was actually a court ruling in Alaska, which upheld ranked choice voting there. And that state Supreme Court actually criticized Maine's previous ruling. And so folks were thinking that applying some of the logic and jurisprudence in Alaska and changing some legislative definitions in Maine might allow for expanding ranked choice voting here in the state without specifically amending the Constitution. So lawmakers had passed a bill, not a constitutional amendment, that changed some of the definitions and language within the existing Maine ranked choice voting law, and were hopeful that that would allow it to be expanded to the to basically to align it with the state constitution and allow it to be expanded to the general election for governor, the general election for state legislative races. But lots of people, pretty much all legislative Republicans and some other folks as well, still felt that that was going to contradict, still run into constitutional issues, that it was going to be unconstitutional, and that expanding it in that way in this election year was a presented some unique and challenging concerns that needed to be resolved immediately. So what they did was they asked for, they said that this is, quote, a solemn occasion, and asked for the state Supreme Judicial Court to weigh in with an advisory opinion on whether that new law or that new proposal, if it became law, would in fact be constitutional here in the state. And so that kicks this advisory opinion process into gear. And so what happens is the justices of the Maine Supreme Court weigh in and provide an advisory opinion. It's not a binding, it's not as if another ruling that has, it's not binding like another ruling would be from the court, but it does basically provide this sort of constitutional interpretation from Maine's top constitutional interpreter. So it is a critical sort of view of the potential constitutionality of a law in Maine, or potential law. And so basically all of the just all seven or not all but a seven of Maine's Supreme Court justices weighed in unanimously to say that this push to expand ranked choice voting through statute rather than as a constitutional amendment would not be constitutional. And so that's a pretty clear message from the court, which is it was unanimous in 2017 as well to say, you really can't do this legislatively. And the interpretation there, it's not exactly what the court said, but the fallout from this ruling essentially is if proponents of ranked choice voting want to expand it to these races, there's really probably going to have to be a constitutional amendment because the state Supreme Court keeps saying that, trying to do it through statute is running into these constitutional problems.
I need a flow chart, I think. This is
There's a
so
lot going on at
complicated.
once.
Well, so what does this mean for people who are going to go to the polls next month?
This means this, so this most recent ruling, and there's been a lot of confusion around this. This does not change anything. The ruling was not that ranked choice voting is unconstitutional, which I think some people have interpreted that being what the court said, and it's not. We have the same status quo that we've had in the previous election, which is a hybrid approach. People in June are going to be using ranked choice voting for governor, for gubernatorial primaries, for state house primaries. But they are not going to turn around and use it in November. So the Supreme Court's advisory opinion has basically locked in the status quo, which is we use ranked choice voting in some, we don't use it in others. And if that's going to change, there are basically two avenues. If it's going to be expanded and applied in all of these elections, it seems pretty clear that there's going to need to be a constitutional amendment. And that requires two-thirds of the legislature approving a constitutional amendment going to the voters, and then a majority of voters statewide need to approve that. Now, since 2016, there have been multiple attempts to do that at the legislative level after the initial Supreme Court ruling that ranked choice voting was not constitutional in certain elections. Democratic lawmakers have tried to expand it with a constitutional amendment. It hasn't gotten the necessary support to move to the voters for a referendum, so it's been stuck. And so I don't personally, this is just my take on it, and I could be wrong, but I don't think that you will see unless Democrats sweep the legislature and have a two-thirds majority, which does not seem likely, you're not going to see that provision get out of the legislature and then get to voters to amend the Constitution. In the reporting on this story, I spoke with the executive director of the Maine Republican Party, who, does not speak for all Republicans, but is a pretty good litmus test on where the party is. And he didn't think that there was any appetite among Republicans to advance a constitutional amendment that would allow for the expansion of ranked choice voting. So that doesn't seem to be going anywhere unless state Republicans drastically change their perspective on ranked choice voting, or if Democrats sweep the legislature in a way that they haven't even in the past 8 years when they've had unified control. So that doesn't seem to be happening anytime soon. I could be missing something. It actually seems more likely that and I don't think this will happen either, but a more likely avenue is that it gets rolled back because if Republicans were to retake particularly both houses of the legislature and then also potentially the Blaine House, it's a lot easier to change statute than it is to change the Constitution. So if Republicans were to have unified control in Augusta, I think you could expect them to pass a new law repealing ranked choice voting based on their current stated position. Now, based on how popular ranked choice voting has been at the polls and with Maine voters, I think you could then potentially see another referendum to in turn overturn that again. So again, it gets very dicey quickly. I think the most likely avenue is probably that we will continue in this hybrid system for the foreseeable future, just because of how complicated the mechanics are around these questions.
Well, I think we could talk about ranked choice voting all day, but we've got Rose here, and I really want to talk to her story to her about her story on Northern Lights finances. First, So, two little things. For listeners who are interested in local government, I want to flag that we held our second Monitor Talks event of the year last week on town meetings and Maine's quirky home rule government structure. It's a really fascinating conversation with municipal leaders in Maine, led by Monitor local editor Judy Meyer. It's up on our website. You should check out the full video. There were some great stories from town meetings in Maine. I laughed a lot more than I thought I would about a panel on municipal government. So definitely check that out. And we need to take a quick break before we talk to Rose. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, I'm joined by Government Accountability reporter Josh Keefe, Elections and Government reporter Matt Yunker, and senior reporter Rose Lundy, who covers healthcare. So, Rose, we are going to switch gears entirely here, and we're going to talk about your story out this last month, where you dove really deep into the financial picture of the second largest healthcare system in Maine, Northern Light Health. First, just tell us a little bit about Northern Light Health. Where does it operate roughly? How many people does it serve? Just give listeners a sense of the system that we're talking about here.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, Northern Light Health is one of Maine's two major health systems covering the state. The other one is Maine Health in primarily southern Maine. Northern Light Health covers the northern two-thirds of the state. Up until recently, it was called Eastern Maine Healthcare Systems, and it rebranded to Northern Light Health in 2018. So it's made up of nine hospitals now. There was a hospital closure last year of Inland Hospital. And it has a very huge range from there's a Portland hospital all the way up to Presque Isle, but it is primarily located in the northern part of the state, and notably a very rural population, and two-thirds of their patients are on Medicare and Medicaid, so a largely public payer population as well. And the reason we looked into this is because it's one of the two major systems, and it's been struggling a lot recently. It's lost money the last 4 years in a row. So obviously there's a lot of readers and other Mainers who are just concerned about what that means for the future of a major health system here in Maine.
Yeah, I mean the numbers here are pretty striking. I think you know in your story you reported out that Northern Light as a whole lost $332 million between 2019 and 2025. A lot of money. They its credit rating plummeted 3 grades. It had three hospital presidents step down. They cut 300 positions. I mean, it's really been kind of dire over the past few years. So just like broadly speaking, why is this so hard? Like, why are they losing so much money lately? What's gone into that?
Yeah, I mean, Northern Light is facing a lot of the financial challenges that a lot of rural health, a lot rural health hospitals are facing. They're not alone in this. There's been some major systemic changes that have kind of really wreaked havoc on their finances. And so the major one that the health executives said to me was inflation. The costs of providing services and labor and drug and supplies have just all gone up so much in the last couple of years, and they've increased twice as much as reimbursement for those services have increased. And so, like I said, they rely heavily on Medicare and Medicaid to cover their patients, and so that's a challenge for the health system. There's also, they operate largely in a rural area, so it's hard to attract staff to work there. And when they can't attract staff, they have to find contract staff to fill in the gaps. And those workers, largely known as traveling nurses, and otherwise they're very expensive contracts that come in on a short-term basis and can drive up their costs for the health system. And then, they're subject to the larger constraints within the health system. We have a lot of closures of other services across the state that can create a bottleneck. A lot of people end up in the ER when they can't go elsewhere. They also can't discharge people to Maine nursing homes because we've had a fourth of our nursing homes close in the last decade. And so when the hospital can't discharge someone to a long-term care or rehab setting, then they stay in the hospital and they don't necessarily get reimbursed for all of the costs associated with that. And then you add on top of it the anticipated result impact of Medicaid cuts. You know, if there are a few people who are covered by Medicaid, then the hospital faces more uncompensated care and charity care, and they don't get reimbursed for those services. So they're anticipating even more cha financial challenges going forward.
Yeah, this really just seems like a confluence of issues over the last 5 years in particular that have made things really challenging. And you looked in particular for this story at Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center in Bangor, which is sort of the flagship hospital of this system. And it's a really, I live not too far from it. It's a really important part of the healthcare system in the northern and eastern part of the state. And you kind of looked at the financial picture for EMMC and traced it alongside the system as a whole over the past few years. What did you find? And was there anything that was surprising to you in there?
Yeah, I frankly was very surprised by the results. I mean, I took on the story because I wanted to look at what exactly is driving these financial challenges for Northern Light. You know, Northern Light likes to look at its finances as a whole, as a system, and so they don't release a lot of information based on a hospital by hospital basis. So I went out and tried to find that information myself, and I expected to see the smaller rural hospitals to be struggling the most because I know through my reporting on other topics, just how challenging it is to operate and provide care in a rural area. But I was surprised to see that their flagship, their major hospital in Bangor, was one of the ones struggling the most. In 2024, it made up half of the system's financial losses that year. The system lost $156 million, and EMMC made up half of that. Its operating margin was negative 8% that year, whereas rural hospitals nationally, their margin was more like 3%. So it was doing worse than national comparisons. And the only Northern Light hospital that year that had a worse operating margin was Inland Hospital, which the system then closed because it was struggling. So it's surprising to see the flagship in that kind of situation. It's lost money 2 out of the last 4 years. It's important to note though that EMMC did better last year. It made $2 million, and the system as a whole did better last year. It only lost $15 million, so that's an improvement from $156 million the year before. But you know, that made me want to understand why their flagship is struggling so much. And so when I talked to the executives about this, they said, you know, actually there's a EMMC is vital to their operations because it offers these complex but expensive services that you can't get at smaller hospitals. And so people go there for these more specialized services. And as a result, you know, the finances might be more challenging there. But it's this interesting kind of paradox as well, though, because the smaller hospitals in the system that look like they're doing better might be doing better because they can operate in a system with EMMC, so they can send their more complicated cases to EMMC. So it's a little complicated, but it's still, you know, the people I spoke to said that it's concerning to see the flagship in this condition.
Yeah, put this into perspective for us, because I mean, I recognize it's a nonprofit, but big businesses lose money all the time, right? And sometimes they lose money for years on end. So, like, is this really a problem?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's a problem for any business to lose money. You know, it's not ideal. But it's important to note that, you know, the Maine Hospital Association talks about how I think it's 40% of hospitals are losing money. So certainly EMMC and Northern Light is not alone in this. It's concerning that it's lost money the last 4 years in a row. I talked to some national experts who said you can have one bad year, two bad years, but once you start getting to 5 bad years, then you're pretty far down the road of financial trouble. Another way to look at the financial situation is that the system as a whole has 60 days cash on hand, which is
Wow.
not a very long time to operate. You know, that's
Yeah.
what they could do if they don't have additional revenue. So that's another way of looking at it. But I also took a look at their debt situation. And so, so Northern Light has about $500 million in debt right now, and issued bonds that it's paying off. But when I spoke to the experts in this space, they said that Northern Light isn't even the biggest borrower in the state. Maine Health has borrowed more than that, and Maine General has borrowed almost as much and is a much smaller system than Northern Light. And so that puts it into some context. And not to get into the nitty-gritty too much, but there's also a number of most hospitals in Maine, or a lot of other hospitals in Maine, don't have bond ratings at all. And so he said if everybody had a bond rating, Northern Light would not have the worst rating of them all. So, the fact that its bond rating has dropped significantly, like I think you mentioned, it's plummeted three grades. That's concerning, but there's many other places that aren't rated at all, and that looks worse financially than to have a low rating. Again, it's important to note that just after my story came out, Northern Light's bond rating did improve slightly. The rating itself stayed the same, but the outlook improved from negative to stable. So that is like a little bit of a tick upwards. So some hope on the horizon, perhaps. The system has done a lot to try to turn around its finances. It's made a lot of cuts, a lot of tough decisions to reduce its costs, and it seems to be getting better. Like I said, the bond rating has improved slightly, and it's lost less money. And so things seem to be turning around, but still has it's yet to be seen if that will be enough to kind of pull it back from the brink.
We only have a couple of minutes left here, but just briefly, what are some things that they are considering to reduce losses? And should people be worried that EMMC will close?
So they have reduced their costs associated with contract workers significantly. They cut 300 positions. They closed two walk-in clinics. They closed a hospital last year. They've reduced the total compensation for their executives. So it used to be 10% of their finances. It's now 4%. So they've brought that down quite a bit, and have just done a lot of work to kind of reduce expenses and increase efficiencies across the system. So, experts I talked to said they're making the right choices. They're relatively optimistic that things can get better. But we're going to see less services across the board in our health system outside of Northern Light, just because that's the reality of the healthcare system going forward. And everyone I spoke to said EMMC is not going anywhere. It will not close. The phrase that came up multiple times and might be a trigger for some people listening to this, but the phrase that came up is too big to fail. Multiple people said that EMMC is too big to fail. We can't let it fail. It's core to the people that it serves and the operations of Northern Light as a whole. And we have to make sure it stays in business in order to keep serving the people of Northern Maine.
Well, as somebody in its coverage area, I certainly hope that's true. You have been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by reporters Rose Lundy, Matt Younger, and Josh Keith. Thank you, all of you, for coming and talking a little bit about your work. And you can read all of their stories at themainemonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have ideas you want to share with the reporters, you can find their emails at themainemonitor.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app. Subscribe to the show as a podcast or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.